Hello and welcome to Uncovered Witness Far Science Revelation, Episode 2. My name is Wojciech Węgrzyński and I'm a professor at the Building Research Institute ITB in Poland. And in my professional engineering career, I do design a lot of buildings and a lot of systems in those buildings to make sure they are safe. I also test the systems to check their reliability and performance. This podcast series is produced together with Halwell Fire Research, a global company specialized in forensic fire science expert witness services, and also research development and design of evacuation in buildings. In this particular podcast episodes, we are trying to uncover the fundamentals of fire science, the basic things that make or break the fire safety in our buildings, and try to present it to general audience so that no matter if you are a seasoned fire engineer or someone who's dealing with the fire professionally for the first time in their career, you'll get a lot of knowledge out of this podcast.
It remains as the 12th deadliest single building fire.
How representative is it of reality?
Lawyers often refer to as the industry standard.
Data that was collected in the 50s, 60s and 70s has been criticized for being for a population of that time.
What are the ignition sources? What things can ignite?
This is Uncovered Witness, the fire science revelations. In the previous episode, we have talked a lot about means of escape and the evacuation routes. How do we choose and mention the exits, the pathways in our buildings to make sure that occupants can escape them? A lot of important knowledge on human movement and where we actually got it from. But in that episode, we haven't talked about where do people know about the fire. We have not talked about what the building does when the fire happens. We have not talked about the technology that's in the building to support the evacuation phase. And yes, this technology is critical in our modern buildings. In this episode, we'll try to go briefly through the fire safety engineering process, the tools and techniques used by fire safety engineers to choose what's appropriate for their buildings, the types of solutions one can put in their buildings, and interesting features of devices such as emergency elevators or rescue areas that we need to consider when we design a really complex building system that's not only fit for abled people, but also with disabled in mind. Perhaps the best way to start this episode is to reflect on a catastrophical fire from the past. In the previous episode, Josh Gibbons, a researcher at Halwell Fire Research, has told us about the Beverly Hills Supper Club. So let's hear Josh once again, and let's hear what types of systems this building had and how they influenced the outcomes of the fire.
The Beverly Hills Supper Club fire, to date, it remains as the 12th deadliest single building fire in US history. It was a fire in Southgate in Kentucky in the USA. And in this fire, 165 people lost their lives. The Supper Club in general was a restaurant and nightclub establishment. It contained about 18 different rooms that could be used for functions and events and weddings, that type of thing. And this made very large, complex, interconnected extensions over the years, essentially. So the building was a bit of a rabbit warren. So the night of the fire, it is believed that the building had around 2,400 to 2,800 people inside, which was double what the building could safely accommodate if you were to use the NFPA codes at the time. And one of the function rooms, which was the largest, known as the cabaret room, which was a large dining restaurant room with a stage at the front. And this one had three times what it could safely accommodate within as compared to the NFPA codes at the time. Like most disasters, there's always usually a string of failures, right? That led to disaster and failure. I guess a little bit more on the building itself. So the establishment did not have any automatic fire sprinkler system. It had no automatic fire alarm system. It didn't even have fire alarm sounders, so no speakers throughout. The only form of fire protection they had was portable handheld fire extinguishers. And there were some fire exit signage, but their full extent was not really known. And additionally, when you look at occupant accounts and people, survivors of the incident, the occupants could not identify all the escape routes. And this was compounded by the decoration inside. So the interior finish where drapes were reported to essentially camouflage exits and doors and that type of thing.
So yes, in fact, the building had not much to help the occupants survive the fire. Unfortunately, 50 years ago, we've built our buildings a little bit different. Thankfully, today, the standards are different. Local jurisdictions often force us to use specific active fire protection countermeasures to increase the fire safety of the occupants in the building. To design those countermeasures, we use something lawyers often refer to as the industry standard. Codes, standards, best guidances, journal papers and scientific bases. With all of this, we're capable of designing fire safety solutions that fit the building that we're designing, that are correct for the intended use of the building, will work with its occupation, and will help us maximize the fire safety at a reasonable cost. This is the fire safety engineering. Now, let's try to reflect of what kinds of solutions engineers can bring into the buildings and what kind of difference those solutions can make on the evacuation process. We're going to discuss the active systems. To understand how those systems are designed, we first need to touch the fundamental basis of fire safety engineering that are behind every single design that we do. To explain that, I've invited the director at Halliwell Fire Research, Dr. Colleen Wade, who's going to take me through an engineering process of a building, and we will choose some fire safety features together.
I guess one of the first things a fire safety engineer is going to do, you know, as part of developing their fire strategy would be to look at, you know, firstly, how long it's going to take someone to evacuate a building in the event of fire, and also how long is available for evacuations. So those two concepts are known as required safe egress time and also the available safe egress time. And from the fire engineering point of view, you want that required safe egress time to be perhaps as short as possible. And you want as much time as you can get before the fire becomes, I guess, unsurvivable or at least sort of threatening to the health of the occupants.
The required safe egress time, perhaps we have not named it in the previous episode, but yes, it was all about that. How do we design our building with occupant evacuation in mind? How do we calculate the movement, the flows, and the times necessary to empty a building? However, let's allow Colleen to reiterate the main points of RSET calculations, so we have easier time understanding the bigger picture in here.
So, you know, with something like the required safe egress time, how long it's going to take someone to evacuate, we need to look at things like travel distance, how far they have to walk. That obviously depends on the size of the building, also the height of the building, because we need to navigate stairs and corridors. Also the degree of familiarity with the building. So if it's a place where you go to work every day, you're going to be much more familiar with the building, with its escape routes, compared to a place that you'd never been in before. And I guess finally, whether actually you are awake or asleep at the time of the fire, because that's going to make a difference as well. So, yep, the fire engineer is going to look at all those things, make some calculations of how long it's going to take you to get out of the building. And then what they're going to do, they're going to compare that with the available safe egress time. So to do that, they're going to look at what are the ignition sources, what things can ignite, what are the contents and the materials, how quickly they burn. So, what, you know, looking at the different possibilities for fire scenarios, and then kind of looking at the different types of fire that could occur. Often fire engineers might kind of categorize them into different sort of growth rates, whether it's going to be a slow growing fire or a very quickly developing fire. They'll need to look at things like how big the space is, how tall it is. That's going to kind of affect how quickly the fire develops. The fire safety engineer is going to look at what fire safety systems the building has, or what systems it might need to have in order to delay the development of hazardous conditions. And that's going to influence the kind of detectors and other systems that they might include. And putting all of that together, they're trying to work out how much time do I have until conditions are hazardous. And obviously the overall calculation is making sure that people can evacuate before conditions are dangerous and threatening.
Here I can only agree. Depending on the place in the world where you are, you might have prescriptive design rules that define everything you should do in the fire, or perhaps you're allowed a full performance-based engineering process. Regardless of one or another, you should always design a safe building, no matter what your regulations tell you. And to do that, you need to calculate if people have a chance to escape the building before the conditions inside turn into untenable ones. The next thing I've asked Colleen is, what properties of the fire environment we are looking at when trying to figure out whether the building is dangerous at this stage or still safe to escape?
There can be a few different measurements, if you like, which are kind of relevant here. One of them is the density of the smoke. and density correlates with the concentration of combustion products. But density also affects whether or not occupants are willing to travel through the smoke. And also the design can influence that. If the design keeps the smoke layer primarily above at some height in the room, above the level of the occupants, then they're going to be exposed to less dense smoke and lower concentration of products. So ultimately, smoke concentration is important because we don't want occupants inhaling and ingesting the combustion products. Other factors which can be important are just things like the temperature. So obviously people can only tolerate set temperature of smoke before they're at risk of either suffering burns from inhaling hot smoke. And so they can be kind of threatened in that way. Also radiation from the fire itself and from flames. They're kind of the main things. And fire engineers will do the calculations of those things and kind of look at the vulnerability of occupants as well, because you can have vulnerable subgroups of people within the building, either the very young or the very old, and they can be a lot more susceptible to the fire effluence.
In the previous episode, we've learned multiple methods to model human evacuation processes. And as you can imagine, we also have ways to calculate and model dynamic changes in the environment inside the building.
There's several different tools that engineers can use to simulate fire. At the very simplest level, it might just be a simple one-line equation or just a simple calculation. Often those simple calculations are based on series of laboratory experiments where they look at the influence of a particular variable. Might be something as simple as looking at the height of the flame, or maybe kind of the amount of entrainment or smoke being generated from a fire plume. So they can be very simple equations. Secondly, a slightly more sophisticated method, which generally uses computer calculation methods, is what's known as a zone model. And a zone model will just subdivide spaces and rooms within buildings into an upper layer, lower layer. So assuming the upper layer is primarily going to consist of smoke. And then they can do calculations over a series of time steps. And they would also have what they call a design fire. So they would have in mind some heat output as a function of time with the given growth rate. And so stepping through those calculations over time, they're going to be making calculations of what's the temperature of the smoke, what's the density of the smoke, and maybe what the concentration of the gases in the smoke be. And they're just going to be approximations, they're going to be time averages. Often that can be all that's required to calculate available safe egress time, as we called it. And then the third method is, I guess, more sophisticated, more complex numerical models, so often known as CFD, computational fluid dynamics. And these are particularly useful where, you know, you've got quite complex geometries within the building. You know, maybe you've got atrium-type spaces, and there's lots of different factors which can kind of influence the flow of smoke within the building. So it's not necessarily nice and uniform layers. But the calculations are kind of in principle the same, that you're still having some assumptions around what the fire source is, and then you're making calculations of, in essence, you know, it's applying principles of energy, momentum, and mass conservation to make those calculations of how hot is it going to be at a particular location, what's the concentration of smoke and carbon monoxide and other gases, what they will be as well.
But even if some of those tools looks like straight from science fiction, their capabilities are to some extent limited. Just like evacuation models cannot truly account for human behavior or predict the behavior of individual agents in their model, the computational fluid dynamics models, even the most advanced ones, are still unfit for the most challenging projects. As Colleen mentioned earlier, the designer chooses what fire will be in the building. It's called a design fire, and it's choice. I've asked a question to Colleen. Does she think if it's possible to accurately model the growth and spread of the fire instead of predefining it?
When it comes to modeling the fire growth and the spread of fire and flame, it's actually a lot more difficult to do that. And it can be possible to make a good effort in, I think, very simple scenarios. But I think in a lot of maybe kind of realistic for scenarios that involve sort of different layers of materials and cavities, it's very difficult. So I think while we can kind of make some estimates, we need to acknowledge that in principle, the uncertainties are actually very high. And, you know, that can be not just the perhaps uncertainties and the material characteristics and what actually might be present in any given building at any given time, because often you don't know that in advance. So you kind of have to be pretty careful, I think, with trying to do those kind of first principles. You know, there are models there, but it takes very expert users to be able to use them and to interpret the results. We have to be a bit careful. Yeah.
So at this point, we know that the fire safety engineer needs to design the building in a way that occupants have sufficient time to escape. We know how to calculate that time. And to some extent, we know how to calculate how much time the occupants will have. Now let's think about all the systems and ways that can improve the chances, which can extend the time that occupants have for their evacuation. All the technology that was perhaps lacking in the Beverly Hills Supper Club, but that we can install in our modern buildings. Let's start with the most fundamental technology, the detection of fire. Because to do anything automatically, the building first has to know that the fire is in it. Explaining me the technologies we use in our modern buildings, again, Dr. Colleen Wade from Halliwell Fire Research.
Yeah, so I mean, virtually any commercial building and most residential buildings, generally, they'll require some kind of alarm system. And often there's also detection requirements. So, you know, the kind of most common one is the smoke alarm system. We'll see that in our homes and pretty much all residential buildings. So the smoke detectors, obviously, they're going to respond to different smoke concentration and maybe different types of smoke. We can also have something like a beam detector, you know, which is a device which has both a receiver and an emitter, and kind of looking at the smoke interrupting the signal from the emitter to the receiver as a kind of smoke detection mechanism, which is quite good in very large kind of atrium type spaces. We can have heat detectors, so they're responding to the temperature of the smoke in the location. And we can have other things like flame detectors, which are actually looking at the kind of infrared signal that they can kind of see from the flame. So there's different operating mechanisms for the different types of sensors.
And each of those sensors have their strengths and weaknesses. You would not like to put a smoke sensor inside the road tunnel because the aggressive environment of the tunnel will quickly destroy it. As well, you cannot put a linear heat detector on top of a giant atrium, because the temperature of the smoke that reaches that point will never be sufficient to trigger that mechanisms. It's those details that the designers have to understand and know and confront with the challenges that the building they are designing brings up to them. And that's just the first of the systems. The next one that has certainly proven its efficiency in real world for more than 100 years, all the systems that are meant to suppress the fire.
The big advantage of a suppression system, sort of over and above what, you know, a smoke alarm system will do, is that the suppression system can do something about the fire. The smoke alarm is only going to kind of warn you that there's a fire. But with a suppression system, and the most common one is a fire sprinkler system. So that's actually going to use water in order to suppress or control fire, stop it growing more quickly, and buy more time for the fire brigades to get in and for the people to escape as well. There's a different types of suppression systems. So the simplest being the kind of water spray sprinkle head, which we're more familiar with. And often what we see in the movies is, you know, it is actually quite wrong. So a sprinkler head will only operate at the location of the sprinkler when the temperature rises sufficiently high. So the idea of one sprinkler operating and all the sprinklers in a space operating at the same time is really very much a myth. So we can have those water-based sprinkler systems, and the technology is such that there are some more specialized systems. a water mist, you know, has a much finer water spray. It can be quite effective at pressing different types of fires with much lower use of water. Other specialised applications actually could be a deluge system. Maybe this is a little bit closer to what we see in the movies, but it's very much a specialised application where the water flow is initiated by some other means.
And again, an entire family of systems, ones fit for small residential apartments, ones fit for petrochemical industry, ones fit for tunnels and others that could be perfect for your sports arena. Again, a multitude of choices for the designer, but the most important out of them all, do we put suppression systems into our buildings or not? It's kind of funny that in the world of fire science, we have something that we can refer to as the sprinkler culture. There simply are countries in the world where sprinklers would be the preferred way to provide fire safety, and other countries, like mine, in which a lot of people would do a lot of stuff to avoid putting sprinklers in the buildings due to the cost or additional work that needs to be done to actually include them properly. But detection and suppression are not the only tools in our toolbox. The next, as important one as the previous ones, is the smoke control. When our buildings become large enough where to buy more time for evacuees to escape the building, we perhaps need to do something with the smoke that will be aggressively attacking them and protect them from this threat.
Yeah, so as our buildings get a bit more complex, and I'm thinking here of buildings with large interconnected spaces or atriums, the fire engineer is looking for, I guess, ways to delay the spread of smoke and to kind of confining it to certain parts of the building. And to do that, they can use different kind of smoke management techniques. So this might be just including something like a kind of smoke extract fan at the roof level to kind of extract smoke. They could also use maybe kind of pressurization systems. So they'll make one part of the building at a higher pressure than another, which will kind of control where the smoke will flow through. And these kind of systems, they can be activated by the fire alarm system. The smoke management systems can be quite simple or they can be very complex. So at the simpler level, you can just use natural smoke management systems whereby you're kind of using openings, smoke vents, and just rely on the buoyancy of hot smoke to rise and to exhaust through kind of natural ventilation openings. And in order to keep the system efficient at low level in the building, you might have other openings that allow the cooler, fresher air to enter and replace the hot smoke. And then as buildings become a bit more sophisticated and you might need a bit more control over those, you know, you would look into kind of mechanical system. So you're using fans and ducts, mechanically extracting the smoke and creating openings at low level to provide a replacement air or actually ducting replacement air into the building.
Not all technologies that we put into the buildings are meant to respond to the fire or smoke. Some of them are meant to proactively help us with the evacuation process. And that is the case of occupant evacuation elevators. To bring me up in this subject, I have invited once again Professor Daniel Nielsen from the University of Canterbury and the director at Halliwell Fire Research.
There is the option of introducing occupant evacuation elevators. So those are elevators that are specifically designed to be safe in case of fire. And in many aspects, in many ways, I would say that they are safer than stairs. And the reason I say that is that we have a large part of our population who have difficulty walking stairs, so people with disabilities. And for those people who have difficulty moving downstairs, an elevator could offer a way out rather than having to wait for assistance in the building. So with stairs, we're actually missing a large part of our population who are not able to evacuate on their own and have really difficulty going downstairs and have to wait for assistance. With occupant evacuation elevators, you often have a lot of safety systems that you add. So compared to the stairs and the minimum requirement for stairs, you can definitely make an occupant evacuation elevator as safe or safer than a stair. We've also done studies where we look at different evacuation strategies in high-rise buildings. So we looked at a 50-story office building, and with the number of elevators you would have in a typical 50-story office buildings. And then in our simulation, if we assume that they were all converted to occupant evacuation elevators, and we looked at the total evacuation time, and if you do force everyone, I mean, it's not reasonable to force everyone to use the elevator, so it's a theoretical case, but let's say you make everyone use the elevator, you can significantly shorten the evacuation time. We're talking half the time or even shorter. And the reason for that, for an office building in particular, is that the elevators are designed to get people into the building quickly. So everyone comes between 8 and 9 in the morning and you need to get them up. They can't wait 2 hours to get to their office. So you have a huge capacity in the occupant evacuation or in the elevators, in the ordinary elevators. If you do convert the ordinary elevators to evacuation elevators, well, the same logic applies that you had enough elevators to get people to their office quickly. So you're going to have enough capacity to get people out of the building quickly. So we're looking at maybe a half an hour if everyone evacuates at the same time, so a total evacuation of the building, versus a stair where you'd be looking at several hours since you get congestion in the stairs.
There obviously must be much more to designing safe emergency evacuation elevators. And I've asked Daniel, how does the elevator prioritize where it should go and to have the optimal evacuation process?
Well, at the moment, if you design an occupant evacuation elevator, it would prioritize the fire floor. So it needs to be connected to the detection system. So if anyone on the fire floor is pressing the elevator button, then the elevator goes to that floor. Some buildings also prioritize floors below or above. So sometimes it's 2 floors above, sometimes it's 1 floor above, sometimes it's 1 floor below. But if anyone presses an elevator button on those floors, then those should also be prioritized. But the fire floor, first of all, and then the other floors close by. And then you have to think carefully about what other floors of the building should be prioritized first. It would make sense in this case to prioritize top floors rather than bottom floors, since bottom floors, particularly looking at fatigue and sort of exertion going downstairs, it would be more of an effort evacuating the top floors than the bottom floors. So there needs to be some type of algorithm that prioritizes fire floor, first of all, and then floors close to the fire floor, and then probably the upper part of the building rather than the lower part of the building.
So all of the beautiful systems that Colleen and Daniel have explained have to cater to the evacuation times that we've previously discussed, to the fire scenario that the designer is developing, to the fire strategy of the building, to the choice of the design fire in the building, its unique hazards coming out from how the building will be used in future. A lot of features that have to be taken into account to design the real good systems that will actually make a difference when fires happen in the building. There are, of course, other systems, and it would take multiple podcast episodes to go in details through all of them. We've just scratched the surface, but from the important ones, we also have evacuation lighting that makes sure that the light is present on the routes of evacuation even when the power is shut down in the building. We have evacuation signs that guide people towards the exits. We have power supply systems that make sure that the building features that are made to support the evacuees and rescue services when the fire is in the building are actually powered up and have sufficient power no matter what happens inside the building. We also have automated systems to send information to fire brigades. In complex buildings, actually, there would be a ton more automation that makes sure that everything is orchestrated as it should. Everything starts in the exact moment when it is supposed to operate. All the openings open just when they're needed. All the shutters close just in time to separate the building and partition it into fire compartments in which the fire is kind of closed and is unable to spread beyond. A beautiful orchestra. Actually, if you follow my other podcast, Fire Science Show, I've spent an entire episode discussing this orchestra and all the things that must click in your building to actually make sure that it is safe. I highly recommend you that podcast episode, which will be linked in the show notes to this one, because it's a nice follow-up to this very introductory stuff we have just discussed with Colleen. So, at this point, we know that there's a fire in the building, and what's more important, the building knows that it is there. What does it do? Of course, all the systems work to give people time, but to get people moving from things that they are currently doing in the building, you have to notify them first, right? And how does the building carry out that notification? Of course, not every building has an orchestra to play God Save the King anthem like in the Edinburgh Theatre fire in 1911. In the modern times, we use technology to convey the messages to people inside of the building, and creating a good message that delivers the information and makes people follow what they're supposed to do, is an art of itself. To explain me that technology is used to give the information to the people inside the building, I've again invited Professor Daniel Nielsen.
So the types of alarms we use for notification of occupants in a building is either signals or sirens or voice alarms. So what we've done in the past is we've collected a lot of data from unannounced evacuation experiments in different types of occupancies. So like cinema theaters, like IKEA stores, Marks and Spencer stores in the Northern Ireland. And we've done unannounced evacuations to figure out how long for this particular type of occupancy, how long does it take for people from hearing an alarm or perceiving another type of cue until they start deliberate movement to a safe place. Now, when we did this research, we also realized that it's not only the type of occupancy that matters. It's also the type of alarm. So if you have a ringing bell, for example, then the desire to get some confirmation of what it is and what the ringing bell actually means is much higher than if you have a voice alarm. So if you have a voice alarm, someone will tell you that a fire has been detected in the building, please evacuate, which gives you more information. So the desire to look for additional information reduces. So in some type of occupancies, like a library would be the example, if you have a ringing bell, there will most likely be quite a bit of hesitation. You wouldn't really understand what the ringing bell means, or you would not feel confident that you knew what it meant. Whereas if you had a voice alarm, it would be relatively clear that this is a fire incident and I need to evacuate. So for a library, I would expect a ringing bell to be a less efficient or a less good siren signal than a voice alarm. A voice alarm would be a very good evacuation alarm. Now, in other type of occupancies, it might not matter as much. So we've done experiments in cinema theaters where you don't really see a big difference between a voice alarm or a ringing bell or a siren of some type. The reason for that would be that people are looking at a screen and they're there to watch a movie and they're looking at a screen. And when the alarm goes off, there's nothing on the screen and there's this annoying ringing in the background, or there is this voice message that's being played. But there's really no reason to be there since there's nothing showing on the screen. So in that case, the difference between a voice alarm versus a ringing bell or a siren is less than it would be in another type of occupancy. In terms of voice alarms, there has been some research on the design of voice alarms. The rule of thumb is that you should have a signal or siren first, followed by a voice message. The reason you have a signal or siren first is to cut through any background noise. So, for example, you might be in a store with a lot of public announcements in the store, advertisement over the intercom. Then you need a unique signal siren to sound so that people listen up and start listening to the voice message, so it's not lost among all the other voice messages that are being played in the store. The next thing is that you should have a call for attention, which is followed by information about what has happened in the building, which is followed by information about what you should do. Now, what research has shown is that it's really important to tell people what has happened. And the reason for that is that people are looking for information as the alarm goes off. If you do not provide them with that information, they will keep looking for that information and you will delay the time it takes before they start evacuating. So the best thing is to tell them that there is a fire alarm or that fire has been detected, since they don't have to look for additional cues to confirm that they need to evacuate. And that shortens the information gathering phase and hence shortens the time it takes for them to start moving out from the building.
At this point, I had to interrupt Daniel, because in my professional career, I've seen something quite opposite happening. I've seen buildings in which instead of telling people there's a fire in the building would say, technical alarm number 27, please go to your nearest exit. And to me, that message was confusing, but the operator of the building said that's how it's written in their manual and how they operate. I had to ask Daniel what he thinks about giving people convoluted and unclear messages when you want them to actually follow your instructions.
You're absolutely correct. So people are looking for clear information so that they can make an informed decision about what to do. So telling them that there is a technical mishap or something very vague means that they would spend time looking for other cues, like, do I really need to evacuate is basically the question that they're asking themselves. Mm. So if you do tell them that there is a fire or that a fire has been detected, then most people will say, well, that sounds really serious and I need to start evacuating. And you can thereby shorten the pre-movement.
And me being myself, I had to follow up again because the art of crafting a really good alarm message is not something you would find in your Fire Engineering 101 book. So I've asked Daniel, what happens if we give too much information to people? Imagine an alarm that says there's a fire happening in alley number 7, row number 3, and at the 7th shelf, and it's growing. Please evacuate immediately. I mean, would that information be more valuable than just saying there's a fire in the building? Or it would be just too much information given to the occupant without any additional value there?
We've also looked at how much information the working memory can take up. And in a stressful situation, you can't overload people with information, since then you will start forgetting the essential information. So it's important to be concise, but still tell them what has happened. It's interesting that you mention the location of the fire, since one theory would be that if you do mention the location, it might seem like unnecessary information, but you also sound very confident, since you know exactly where the fire is. So even though you're adding more information, it could be argued that you're actually adding credibility to your message as well. But at the same time, you should not give them too much information, since if you do, then you get information overload and you start forgetting the important parts of the message. So keep it concise. Tell people what has happened and tell them what to do.
With some modern technologies in the building, like the evacuation elevators or areas of refuge, the successful operation of them is related not only to the information that the fire is there in the building, but kind of in both ways communication with people waiting in these spaces. So they are informed of what's happening around and they do not suddenly change their mind about waiting for an elevator or staying safe in a place that is meant to provide them with safety. This two-way communication is another substantial challenge in provision of the safety by the building features. Here, once again, Professor Daniel Nielsen.
In recent years, more research has been done on the evacuation of people with disabilities, particularly with movement disabilities. A lot of this research is linked to some of the features that have been introduced in buildings, like occupant evacuation elevators and areas of refuge, which, when they're introduced in legislation, don't always work well. An example of this would be an area of refuge, which is where in an area in a building which is designed to be safe and is designed for a person in a wheelchair to be able to use while everyone else evacuate and basically wait for assistance in the area of refuge. One of the problems in many legislations around the world is that there wasn't much guidance on how to design these areas of refuge. So it was basically an area where you waited. And sometimes there is a requirement to have two-way communication. But not much information is provided on what that two-way communication should look like. So it's up to the engineer to decide what the two-way communication would look like. And sometimes that is not really a good system that is interpreted or that people understand as being safe. So for example, one design that I have seen is a display with a flashing light on it, or it's actually a light and a button, and you press the button and then the light starts flashing in front of the person who's sitting in a wheelchair. And that means that the signal has been sent. Once the person has been looking at this flashing light for a long time, if someone receives the alarm and acknowledges it, then it switches to a solid light. Now, this type of system has been tested and it's been shown that people in wheelchair, they simply don't want to sit there and just wait for this flashing light to become a solid light, but they often want to evacuate on their own and not just wait for assistance. So areas of refuge and the design of areas of refuge is an example of where we might not design the systems in a good way, in a way that makes the people in wheelchairs feel that they're in a safe place and can wait for assistance.
And this seemingly small issue in engineering with not perfectly defined solution that needs to be placed in the building, this opens a whole rabbit hole that we will go into for the next podcast episode. But let's allow Daniel to tease you into what we will be talking in the episode 3 of The Uncovered Witness.
sometimes in regulations, you introduce solutions which are not interpreted the way that you intend. Now, areas of refuge for people with movement disabilities is an example of this. They exist in regulations around the world, like the UK and Sweden have them as well in their regulations. But often much is left to the interpretation of the designer. So you get some advice about two-way communication, but not what this two-way communication should look like, which means that the person who uses this area of refuge might not feel safe. And now, ongoing research at the University of Canterbury is looking at how you design these types of communication systems for areas of refuge and occupant evacuation elevators. The approach that is used is slightly unique. We use something called co-creational design, which means that we build different areas of refuge with communication systems in virtual reality. And then we go to a person with a movement disability and show them these environments in virtual reality. And as we do that, we interview them about their experiences and we ask them to tell us what works and what doesn't work with this design for us to be able to understand what design features we need to change. And in an iterative way, together with a person with movement with disabilities, we then find a design that is acceptable and that they would interpret in the way it's supposed to be interpreted, and they can then feel more safe when they're using areas of refuge or occupant evacuation elevators.
Yeah, what you just mentioned is a really interesting case that if the legislator defines something and engineers can interpret it in a different way, completely free, and perhaps the building administrator can have in their own definition and the firefighters can have their own definition, it creates a very difficult conundrum of what the engineer is actually responsible for and to what extent they can engineer.
I completely agree with you. If you leave too much to the imagination or inventiveness of the engineer, for example, then you might design a system. Since you don't get a lot of information about what that system should look like, there might not be a standard. And if you design that in a way so that it is misinterpreted during the evacuation, then an interesting question is where the liability lies. Is it with the regulator? Is it with the engineer who designed the system? And that, I haven't seen a case yet where we've experienced this. But as you rightly point out, if it's left to the imagination of the engineer to make up a system, then if it doesn't work, there is a potential liability.
And this is where we end the journey into the systems that we use in our buildings to make the evacuation processes happening, to save lives, to make sure that people can safely escape the buildings where there's fire inside of them. In this episode, we went through the mind of an engineer, what they go through when designing a building, scratching the surface, really at the tip of an iceberg of knowledge that someone has to have to design successful operating systems in a building that achieve their goals. We've went through the tools of an engineer. How can they verify if what they're designing is correct? How can they measure? What do they measure inside of the building to say if it's better or worse? We've discussed how engineers need to provide sufficient time for evacuation and how the available and required safe evacuation time concepts are still a prevalent way to design fire safety in the buildings. Finally, we've discussed some of the most interesting features of evacuation. How does the building communicate with the user and how a two-way communication can be achieved? How can we develop and improve this in the future? In the next podcast episode, we will talk just what Daniel and I have discussed at the end of the episode. How can engineer design a better system when the law tells you you have to put evacuation doors in the place of your building? How do you make those evacuation doors better? There will be a ton of solutions that are certified, that have the correct rating that you can place in the spot. But how do you say one solution is better than another one? For this, we will go deep into something called the theory of affordances that lets us know how stuff is used by people and how can we make those things more useful in the evacuation process. So please feel highly welcome to the next episode of Uncovered Witness Fire Science Revelations to learn what codes do not tell you, but what you can do better to provide safety to your building and your occupants. Thank you for listening to this episode. Thank you to the guests participating in this recording, Josh Gibbons, Dr. Colleen Wade and Professor Daniel Nielsen from Halliwell Fire Research. Big shout out to Halliwell Fire Research for sponsoring and participating in the production of this podcast series. See you here in the next episode. Cheers.